The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy. Red yeast rice lowered cholesterol to target. Question. Thank you for advice on controlling cholesterol. I'm a 77-year-old woman of normal weight. My cholesterol hovered around 200, even with a strict diet and getting plenty of exercise. Total 197, HDL 77, LDL 101. My primary doctor said that this must be hereditary and wanted to put me on a statin. Instead, I started taking red yeast rice and sprinkled at least 1/2 teaspoon of turmeric and at least 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper on each meal. After doing this for about 4 months, continuing my exercise and strict diet, my total cholesterol dropped to 162, HDL 77, LDL 76, triglycerides 47. My pharmacist confirmed that red yeast rice would not interfere with any of my other medications. I hope this helps others. Answer, we are impressed with your results. You are not in bad shape to start with. An HDL of 77 is considered excellent. So are your other lipid levels. Red yeast rice contains natural statins. A meta-analysis of 13 randomized placebo-controlled trials concluded that red yeast rice is an effective and relatively safe approach for high cholesterol, and that's the POLS-1 study, June 4th, 2014. The active ingredient in turmeric, or curcumin, has been shown to reduce triglycerides and raise beneficial HDL cholesterol. That's cited in critical reviews in Food Science and Nutrition online, November 29, 2017. Looking for a safer sunscreen. Question. In the Consumer Reports ratings on sunscreen, most of the top-ranked lotions contain oxybenzone, a.k.a. benzophenone 3 or BP3. You have warned previously about the possible hormone-disrupting or endocrine-disrupting effects of this chemical in many articles. What are we to do? The answer? You're right that many of Consumer Reports' top-rated sunscreens contain oxybenzone. Nevertheless, the organization acknowledges that the chemical contributes to coral bleaching. CR also notes that Hawaii has banned sunscreens containing oxybenzone starting in 2021. The Environmental Working Group is a nonprofit organization promoting human health with attention to environmental effects. It warns that oxybenzone is a toxic chemical that is harmful to our health and our planet. It's linked to hormone disruption and allergic skin reactions in people, as well as the bleaching of coral reefs and coral death. That's why the organization is campaigning to have oxybenzone removed from sunscreens. EWG found it in a majority of the products they reviewed this year, but they also found more than 200 products that do not contain oxybenzone. You can check the list at EWG.org. Question. I keep having severe leg cramps. I am old enough to remember when my doctor prescribed quinine for them. Now I can't find quinine capsules anywhere. A pharmacist suggested I check with you. Is there any way you can help me find quinine capsules or something close to them? Answer, quinine is no longer available over the counter or by prescription to treat leg cramps. The Food and Drug Administration determined that the risk of severe reactions was too high for the modest benefit of alleviating leg cramps. Doctors can prescribe quinine, which the brand name is Qualiquin, but only to treat malaria. There are some homeopathic cramp remedies that contain minuscule amounts of quinine. The FDA does not regulate these as drugs, but rather as dietary supplements. You also can get quinine in tonic water. Some people find that drinking a glass of tonic at bedtime can ward off nighttime cramps. You can find several other remedies for leg cramps in our guide to leg pain. Question. I have been on meloxicam to treat arthritis pain for about a month now. I had a procedure done yesterday, and the nurse told me to keep an eye on my blood pressure until I see my doctor again. I checked it again this evening, and it was 168 over 117. My blood pressure was never this high before I started taking meloxicam. Could the drug be raising my blood pressure? Answer. The official prescribing information for meloxicam, or the brand name Mobic, states NSAIDs, including Mobic, can lead to new onset or worsening of pre-existing hypertension, either of which may contribute to the increased incidence of cardiovascular events. All non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, including ibuprofen and naproxen, have the potential to raise blood pressure. You definitely should discuss this problem with your physician at your earliest opportunity. Other side effects of meloxicam include digestive distress, skin rash, dizziness, ringing in the ears, elevated liver enzymes, kidney damage, blood clots, heart attacks, and strokes. Personal health from the New York Times by Jane Brody. How to increase your chances of having a long, healthy life. Where is the best place in America to live if you want to maximize your chances of living longer? Based on a new state-by-state study of the American burden of disease, disability, and premature death, and how it has changed from 1990 to 2016, you might want to consider setting down roots in Hawaii, where residents have the longest life expectancy of 81.3 years. But if your goal is to live long and stay healthy as long as you can, call Minnesota your home, which outranks every state in the District of Columbia for average length of healthy life expectancy, 70.3 years. Of course, the biology of the native population plays a role in how long and how healthfully people live in various parts of the country, and the opportunities people have for a good education, financial security, quality medical care, and environmental safety also make important contributions. But the big enchilada, as this comprehensive study demonstrates, is how people live their lives, whether they smoke, what and how much they eat, and whether they abuse alcohol or drugs. These, along with high levels of blood sugar and blood pressure, both of which are influenced by diet, are the main factors dictating poor health. About three-fourths of the variation in life expectancy between counties can be explained by these big risk factors. Dr. Christopher J. L. Murray, the new study's lead author, said in an interview, "Much more is due to the socio-cultural environment, especially what people eat, than to their genes or the physical environment." Alas, the study did not measure the contribution of regular exercise to longevity and long-lasting health. There's not as much research on the effects of physical activity as there should be, said Murray, epidemiologist and health economist at the University of Washington, adding that exercise most likely contributes to the major risks that were measured. Public policy and personal behaviors should foster the ability to live free of chronic disease and disability well into old age, in other words, to maximize the chances of adding both years to life and life to years for as many people as possible, according to Dr. Howard K. Koh, K-O-H. The findings of the study can and should provide a blueprint for everyone, the public, the medical profession, and government agencies, to achieve this vitally important money-saving and health-saving goal. But it is a goal that depends heavily on preserving a critical component of the Affordable Care Act, full coverage without copays, for an array of counseling and screening interventions relevant to tobacco use, diet, hypertension, and exercise. Statin preventive medication and aspirin preventive medication, depression and cancer, breast, lung, colon, rectal, skin, cervix, co, and Powrett wrote, "Everyone needs insurance to access health care services. That's an essential part of health," co, a professor of public health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, told me, "and preventive services covered by the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, are needed to give everyone the opportunity to achieve the highest attainable state of health, a goal established by the World Health Organization. Dr. Murray's study shows that too many people are not enjoying that opportunity," Coe said. "It should be a call to action for the country. As a clinician who cared for patients for more than 30 years, I saw too much suffering and death that should have been prevented." From the Wall Street Journal, "Is the big clinical trial obsolete? Sweeping clinical trials in which thousands of patients are studied for years at a stretch have long been the holy grail of medical research, especially when funded by the federal government. But in the era of personalized medicine, where care can be tailored to a person's genetic makeup and doctors analyze a patient's DNA to figure out treatments, big trials are falling out of favor. Instead, many researchers are arguing for smaller, nimbler trials that involve fewer patients and take less time. This has pitted those who believe small trials make more sense against those who worry that large trials are being cast aside in favor of flash-in-the-pan approaches that won't stand the test of time or efficacy." To Ursula Matulonis, who treats ovarian cancer and other women's cancers at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, "the debate over trial size has a special urgency. Many of her patients are desperately sick. You can't wait years to get these medications approved. What we are dealing with are women with cancers and their lifespans are limited. They need medications and they need them now, and they are not looking to wait for 5 years," says Dr. Matulonis, chief of gynecological oncology. "That is why flexibility in a trial size is crucial," she contends. "As we become more genetically astute and understand a type of cancer better, I think those large randomized trials will be hard to do. There won't be that many patients that fit into one big group," she adds. One of her patients, Janet Sheehan, is grateful for the small clinical trial she has taken part in for the past 5 years. Ms. Sheehan, a 63-year-old nurse near Boston, was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer a dozen years ago. It has come back 3 times, and at one point she learned that she had a mutation in the BRCA1 gene, which indicates a strong predisposition to breast and ovarian cancer. Dana-Farber suggested in 2013 that she go on a randomized 90-person trial for a drug named olaparib that showed promise among women with BRCA1 gene mutation. She has been taking capsules twice a day and going for checkups every 28 days since then. Despite side effects, she has been able to work and carry on. "I have seen my children grow and have seen grandchildren I didn't have then," she says. Ms. Sheehan was on a randomized trial when both groups of patients received treatment with olaparib. One group got the drug only, the other received olaparib in combination with another drug, her doctor said, adding, "there was no placebo." "The big randomized clinical trial is an endangered species," says the senior author of a recent study that charted a decline in clinical trials funded by the National Institutes of Health. "Everyone wants an answer in a hurry. Everyone wants to study a few patients," says Curtis Medert, professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In a study published this year in the journal Clinical Trials, Dr. Minert and a team of researchers found that the number of NIH-funded trials declined to 930 in 2015 from 1,580 in 2005, a 41% drop. Clinical trials are critical for generating high-quality evidence to guide clinical practice and improve public health, the study said, adding that the decline in trials could be explained by a flat NIH budget that has resulted in approximately 20% less in real dollars in 2015 than in 2005. The study said that the decline also could be explained partly by rising costs of trials. In a statement, NIH said, while NIH funding for clinical trials has not decreased, the combination of increasing costs to run clinical trials, for example, cost per patient enrolled, and reduced buying power has resulted in a fewer number of trials being funded. Dr. Meinert, 83 years old, has worked on clinical trials since 1960. NIH has spent more and more money on small trials with a sample size of, say, 50 people, he says, yet only miracle cures can be found with trials that small. Industry has stepped in to fund trials, but concerns persist over potential bias. NIH data is very reliable, Dr. Meinert says. A statement by James Doroshow of the National Cancer Institute, a part of NIH, said that the National Cancer Institute, sees smaller, more focused trials as a positive trend. Dr. Doroshow, NCI's Deputy Director for Clinical and Translational Research, said that as knowledge of cancer deepens, it means we can complete trials that provide thorough answers with fewer participants at lower costs and in less time. Advocates of smaller trials say it isn't only about money. It also is about discovering effective treatments. People have to rethink the value of the large clinical trial in an era of personalized medicine, says Nicholas Shork, professor at the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Phoenix. With genomics, doctors are trying to match drugs to individual patients' features, so the sorts of trials we need will look much different than the large clinical trials, he added. The debate is surging days before the results of a large clinical trial are to be unveiled at the American Society of Clinical Oncology's annual meeting. In a marriage of modern genomics with a classic randomized trial, researchers followed about 6,700 women, breast cancer patients, for several years to see if they could safely be treated without chemotherapy. The trial centers on a genomics test known as Oncotype DX that can indicate how aggressive a woman's breast cancer will be by assigning it a genetic score. In recent years, the test has been widely used by doctors trying to decide whether patients with early stage breast cancer needed chemotherapy. The recent trial known as TAILOR focused on women with more complex breast cancer to see if they, too, could be spared chemotherapy, a treatment that can be toxic. Larry Norton, a breast cancer specialist and senior vice president at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, points to TAILORx as the classic example of why large trials are important. No matter the results, they will influence clinical practice, he says. Dr. Norton stressed that he believes in small trials and does some himself, but has been concerned that large trials have increasingly been critiqued as unnecessary. TAILORx disproves that. The results will affect the care of 100,000 women in the United States, he said, because the women will or won't receive chemotherapy, and that guidance could only have been achieved through a large trial. To Dr. Norton, the debate may stem from a divide in worldviews among scientists. Young people entering medicine have embraced the zeitgeist of smaller, faster trials. It is probably related to the digital age and the need for immediate gratification, he says. At a recent symposium at the annual meeting of the American Society of Breast Surgeons titled Why Big Trials Still Matter, Dr. Norton cast a critical eye on small trials. He warned that most discoveries and advances are modest. For example, a drug that reduces the risk of death by 25%, and statistically, they are more likely to be uncovered in the course of large trials and missed in small trials. I think that we are throwing away a lot of good drugs and a lot of good diagnostics because our trials are too small, he said. At Genomic Health, the company that produced the test in the TaylorRx trial, co-founder Stephen Schack, the lead developer of the Oncotype DX test, says it came about after many small trials. Small trials can lead to significant innovations, he said, and are critical to developing technologies. Of course, he added, big trials are crucial to determine if these new innovations really work. Now from the Harvard Health Letter. Staving off dementia when you have mild cognitive impairment. The shift from this condition to dementia is not necessarily inevitable. Will I get dementia? The common question takes on urgency if you have mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, a slight but noticeable change in memory and thinking skills. But the progression from MCI to dementia is not automatic. In fact, MCI is not always permanent. It depends on the underlying cause, says Dr. Joel Salinas, a neurologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. What are the causes of MCI? MCI is not dementia, but it's not normal thinking either. It often stems from disease or treatments for disease, including degenerative brain disease such as Alzheimer's disease, in which case MCI is often a precursor to dementia, stroke or other vascular disease, traumatic brain injury, a medication side effect, or underlying health problems such as sleep deprivation, depression, or anxiety. Symptoms. There are two kinds of MCI in both symptoms. And both symptoms are not severe, although they can be upsetting and disruptive. Amnestic MCI is memory specific and is marked by signs like forgetting conversations and misplacing items. Non-amnestic MCI involves changes in other brain activities regardless of whether you have memory loss. It may show up as problems with language. You lose your train of thought during a conversation, attention. You have a hard time accomplishing tasks like bill paying, or spatial sense. You can't find your way around a familiar place. Prevalence and progression. New MCI treatment guidelines from the American Academy of Neurology, the AAN, based on the latest evidence, notes that globally more than 6% of people in their 60s have MCI. The number climbs to more than 37% by age 85. The guidelines, which were published online December 27, 2017 by Neurology, also note that MCI cases progress to full-blown dementia about 15% of the time among people 65 or older. Dr. Salinas says the progression is much more likely if neurodegenerative disease such as Alzheimer's is causing the MCI. But how long it takes for MCI to progress to dementia is anyone's guess. If it's Alzheimer's disease, it may take about 2 to 5 years. But I've seen patients stay in the MCI stage for many years, even when we presume it was a neurodegenerative disease, Dr. Salinas says. Staving off dementia. Dr. Salinas says MCI can often be reversed if a general health condition, such as sleep deprivation, is causing the decline. In these cases, addressing the underlying cause can drastically improve cognition. When MCI can't be reversed, treatment is challenging. There are no pills to slow the worsening of memory problems. But the AAN did find encouraging evidence linking exercise with better memory in people with MCI. Exercising can offer mental and social stimulation while improving blood flow to the brain, possibly even prompting the release of molecules that repair brain cells and create connections between them. The new MCI treatment guidelines recommend exercising at least twice a week. The AAN also notes that cognitive training may improve thinking skills, although the evidence is weak. Cognitive training involves computer or video-based exercises that push you to sharpen your response times and attention. But those improvements don't clearly carry over to day-to-day life. More habits, more impact. The 2015 FINGER, F-I-N-G-E-R, trial, a randomized controlled trial, the gold standard of research, found less cognitive decline over 2 years in older adults who maintain a combination of habits, such as eating a healthy diet, exercising regularly, and taking part in social events. The adults in the study did not have MCI, but some were at risk for Alzheimer's disease. Similar trials are being conducted around the world. Dr. Salinas says people with MCI can take a cue from these types of findings to maintain as many healthy habits as possible. That includes not only exercising, eating right, and staying connected with other people, but also engaging in mentally stimulating activities, particularly learning new things like a new hobby or a new language, and taking medications as prescribed. There are no guarantees, but the evidence suggests these steps may delay or even prevent progression to dementia. The people who spend the most time cognitively stable are often the ones who stick to lifestyle recommendations, says Dr. Salinas. What is dementia? Dementia is a condition of persistent impairment in brain activities, like thinking or speaking, that is severe enough to interfere with daily life. Medical conditions such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, traumatic brain injury, and strokes are common causes of dementia. Symptoms can include forgetfulness, confusion, and the new inability to solve routine problems. So we'll also review in the next weeks, Ask the Doctor from the Harvard Health Letter, which is why am I losing weight and can you get heart problems despite a healthy lifestyle? And there are also 7 reasons why you may need a medication checkup and tips for your drug checkup and the surprising side effects from using technology. Salad greens, getting the most bang for the bite. And finally, can this DNA test help predict your longevity? Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.